This is Music Respawn. I'm Kate Remington with John Paul Hayward, and it's really great to meet you and have a chance to talk.
It's nice to meet you too, Kate. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, your project, Cross Symphonic, it's a symphonic tribute to the incredible music of Chrono Cross. And first of all, congratulations on your really successful Kickstarter campaign.
Oh, thank you very much. It was third time is the charm.
Well, clearly, I mean, you went double the goal. And so there's so much love for the music from Chrono Cross. And I guess that just really illustrates that the fans are there. You just have to tap them on the shoulder and say, hey, right?
Right. Well, the Chrono Cross fans are actually a hard bunch to get in touch with, you know, franchises like Final Fantasy or The Legend of Zelda, things like that. There are dedicated communities or, you know, certain spots that you can find huge pockets of these fans. When it comes to the Chrono games, Trigger and Cross, they're just kind of spread everywhere. So there's not a catch-all formula. So it was really a challenge to try and get in touch with as many people as possible.
Yeah, I bet. Well, I'm sure, you know, once word got out, there was a lot of networking that happened. And it's so cool because, I mean, clearly this was really a passion project for you. And so how old were you? I mean, if you can say, how old were you when you discovered Chrono Cross for the first time?
Well, I'm actually a pretty young guy. So Chrono Cross came out when I was 9 years old, I think. 1999. Yeah, 9 years old. I was born in 1990.
Wow.
So I had played it somewhere around 2001, picked it up from a local game store, and I absolutely loved it. But my mom thought it was too mature for me, and she made me sell it.
I didn't
end up revisiting it again until I was in high school, and then I really fell in love with it again in college somewhere around 2010. Which is when I kind of went back through a phase of playing all these old games that I grew up playing, and I picked that one up again and instantly just fell completely in love with it. And I would say probably to this day, it's in my top five favorite games of all time.
Wow. Why is that? What is it of that game that like really speaks to you?
It's really hard for me to pinpoint. I've had this question from a few different people. One of the things I always end up coming back to is the tropical island setting of the game has always been extremely attractive to me. I don't entirely know why, but the story in Cross has always been really intriguing to me. It's lauded as not being a very good sequel to Chrono Trigger by a lot of people. It's one of those games that you either love or hate.
Well, I heard that they didn't even mean for it to be a sequel. It was just like another part of the story.
Right. Well, it was never supposed to be a direct sequel. That's true, in the sense that it's not the same characters. You know, it's not kind of the same overarching plot through the series. But the more I play it and the more I replay it, the more you pick up on how they tie the two universes together and the two stories together. And I always thought that was really, really cool, the way they could kind of just snake them in together and without you even realizing it. And I always thought that was a really cool approach, because I get kind of tired of what I call the Marvel syndrome, where you have a plot with this super powerful enemy or, you know, bad guy that's essentially this godlike being that threatens your story, threatens your party, and you have to go out and destroy that. And then they produce a sequel, and of course, now you have to one-up that super powerful godlike being with an even more super powerful godlike being, and it gets old, in my opinion. So the way they did Cross, I thought was really cool. Just take the same universe, interweave the stories loosely, and then create a whole new epic to experience.
Yeah, and the way that there are these parallel universes is just, it's so fascinating. And I'm just wondering, on which playthrough was it that you really noticed the soundtrack by Yasunori Mitsuma?
Oh, instantly. Absolutely instantly. His music has been inspirational to me pretty much as long as I can remember. He did the soundtrack to Chrono Trigger as well, which is the original that came out in 95, I believe. And I played that when my older brother had it on Super Nintendo, and I played the crap out of that game. I attribute that game and Final Fantasy III, which is technically Final Fantasy VI, it came out as III in the United States. Those two games I really attribute to my love for music. Like, I've always been involved in music my entire life, but those two games spoke to me on some kind of deeper level. I remember as a kid, I had an old cassette recorder, and so I would go and I would actually just turn on the games and sit in different areas and record the songs that would sit there and loop, and then listen to them on my own free time. And that's probably the first instance of listening to music for fun that I can actually remember.
Wow, that's so cool. And I've heard from a lot of people that that's what they used to do, because you couldn't buy the soundtrack. And so the only way to hear the music from the game was to just either record it like that, or, you know, make your own arrangements and then play them on the piano or whatever. And so did you do that too?
I certainly tried. I would try and sound them out on the piano all the time, and ended up with the completely wrong chord progressions, but actually served as the basis for a couple of arrangements by themselves, just happy accidents.
Wow. Well, your cross symphonic project, I mean, talk about an epic project. I mean, reimagining all of these amazing themes from Cross and giving them new light, and then orchestrating them too. So what was the spark that got the whole project going?
It was kind of a combination of things, which again stretches clear back to my childhood. When in high school, I used to search iTunes. When iTunes was brand new, I used to search it all the time for video game music, which, as you know, was basically non-existent back in the late 90s, early 2000s.
Yeah.
And so I would search for video game music all the time, specifically orchestral video game music, because I really have a love for the orchestra. I've always had a love for the orchestra. And the other is fun, but it's never spoken to me quite like orchestra music has. And so I used to search iTunes all the time for video game orchestral concerts, things like that. And somewhere around 2003, 2004, Square held a couple of Final Fantasy concerts in Japan that somehow made their way to iTunes. Absolutely loved those. And then later on, of course, they did the Distant Worlds concert series, which is still running today, which is symphonic music from Final Fantasy. And that, I always thought that was really, really cool. And when that first came out and I first discovered that, you know, I was so excited that Square was starting to do things with their music like that. I kept waiting and waiting and waiting for there to be a Chrono Trigger or a Chrono Cross version. And, you know, they teased us a little bit with a medley here and there, but never really gave us anything to stand on. And so I always thought, even back in high school, as I started to get more and more into music and more into composing, that, you know, maybe one day I'll just do my own if they don't do one. And so fast forward, I don't know, 10 years or so, then the Final Symphony album came out. I don't know if you're familiar with that one. That one's fantastic. They took the music from Final Fantasy VII and they turned it into a full-fledged symphony in three movements. Mm-hmm. And I was just floored by that. I am still floored by that. I listen to it every once in a while. It's just masterful. And it was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back. You know, I'd been doing my own orchestra stuff for several years now, working with different orchestras and choirs. And I said, you know what? I think that I'm ready. I'm gonna do this. That was the straw that broke the camel's back. Let's start a Chrono project. And that was probably 2017, I think, that I made that decision.
Wow. So it's been a really long road. And it's very, very cool that you were able to wrap up the Kickstarter and get Cross Symphonic released on the exact day, the 20th anniversary, that Cross was released in Japan.
Yeah. What a whirlwind.
Yeah, I'm sure. And we could talk about how you made all of that happen. But one of the things I'd love to just dive into right now is you used sort of the ideas of the themes and you kind of touch on them. Mm-hmm. And yet you've got this duality because you're creating something brand new. So what was sort of the process? First of all, how did you choose from all of the incredible music by Mitsuma? And then, you know, how did you use the themes and then keep it kind of in your own voice too?
Oh, that's a good question.
It's a big question.
It is. Well, as far as choosing the themes, I mean, I tried to touch on as many as possible, but it kind of all goes back to the goal of the project. So when I originally started this project, I was just going to take every single theme from the soundtrack and orchestrate it as is. So I wasn't going to really change anything. I was just going to change the medium in which it was presented. And I started that. I think I made it three tracks in, and I had this new idea. Actually, it was partially inspired by a friend of mine, Sam Dillard, who released an album called Chrono Cinematica that I discovered while researching Cross Symphonic. And what he did was he gave these kind of cinematic orchestral recreations of different themes from Chrono Trigger, and he kind of medleyed them and made this cinematic orchestra approach. And I thought that was really, really cool. And I took that to the piano more or less and said, okay, I want to do something kind of similar to that, but maybe take it a step further. Rather than just present these in a cinematic way, I want to retell this entire story from Cross as if it were a soundtrack, as if it were from a movie.
Wow. And
so what I did is I started sitting down, looking at all the themes. And of course, I've, you know, played this game 100 times by now, so I know the story backwards and forwards. Or at least I like to think that I do. And so I sat down with the music and I said, okay, how can I illustrate this story using themes from the game? And that's really how I picked different themes. I took what Mitsuda had assigned different characters, assigned different situations. I mean, he already masterfully tells the story, but he always did it in context of being supplementary music to visuals, right?
Yeah.
And so my goal now was to, how can I retell this story without any visual, without any context? And that's kind of how it came to fruition.
Such an easy, just really a cool story arc, because yeah, you can really follow the path of the characters and the story. And, mm-hmm. you know, there's so many characters in Cross. And besides the main three, you know, who were some of the characters that you really wanted to include in the story arc and with themes in Cross Symphonic?
Beyond the, you know, the obvious choices, one of the characters that I did want to highlight was Harl, which is Lynx's, who is the main bad guy at the time, his sidekick. And she serves as a really important story element without giving too many spoilers. I mean, she's integral to the story, both in the beginning and in the end for different reasons. And she was a character that I wanted to play heavily on. Lynx, who is arguably one of the main characters, was an interesting one because Mitsuda really didn't write a theme for him. So, I mean, he has a song that plays kind of, you know, when Lynx is around, but he also uses that song in several other situations. So it's not necessarily what I would call a theme for Lynx. And so I ended up writing my own motif for it, which you hear for the first time in track 3, A Theft for a Life. And then again, is really expanded upon in Betrayal. And then again in track 12, which is Battle for the Frozen Flame, which is kind of the penultimate moment for Lynx and Surge in their conflict.
That track, it oh man, I can really hear how much you love the music of John Williams, and and
yes.
Also there's a little bit of, you know, Stravinsky's Firebird in there too. It's
yes John Williams, he was the other facet of this project, because, you know, as you can hear in my music, I am a huge John Williams fan. Apart from probably Yasunori Mitsuda, Nobuo Uematsu, John Williams would be my most inspirational composer, outside of the video game world, it's kind of him, Rachmaninoff, a bit of Tchaikovsky, and I do quite enjoy Stravinsky from time to time. Those kind of serve as my main pools of inspiration.
Well, what's so cool about all of them is that they have such a gift for writing melody.
And exactly.
Yeah, so that's really cool. And so if you're going to, if you're going to point to musical heroes, that's a good bunch right there.
Oh, yeah. Well, melody is one of my favorite things about music. You know, one of my favorite things about John Williams especially is you'll get into these massive sweeping movements, you know, the orchestra is full and rich and lush, and suddenly he'll take all of the strings and the brass and the woodwinds and all just in unison play this melody line with, you know, this tonal foundation in the low brass where you have these big rich chords that are just blasting away and this huge melody soaring over the top of everything. And I absolutely love that and try to recreate that in my music as much as possible. Of course, no one quite does it like the master does, but I think I had some really nice moments in Cross Symphonic where I tried to accomplish that as well.
Yeah, well, besides The Battle for the Frozen Flame, what are some of the other tracks that you're especially proud of the way they turned out?
Oh, that's a tough one. It's kind of like asking you to choose your favorite child.
Or pet.
Yeah, right. That's a good one.
Well, if you'd rather just say, I love them all equally, that's fine too.
Well, it would be mostly true, but somewhat of a lie. I could tell you which ones I like less than others, if that helps.
Sure, and maybe why they didn't quite come up to the high bar that you set.
Sure. Well, interestingly enough, track 4 was one I never cared for when writing, which is called The Antidote.
Yeah.
I always felt that it was kind of a quick sellout track where I just, you know, It came together really fast. I felt like a lot of thought went into it. But when we actually put it in front of the orchestra, it turned out to be one of the most fun tracks for me to work on and listen to. It completely turned around for me.
Thank you. Was that the difference between hearing it with the samples that you used as a mock-up versus hearing it performed by the live musicians?
Oh, totally. Totally. That's another facet of this project that really surprised me. I mean, you may or may not know, when we did this third Kickstarter, the one that ended up being successful, we set a lower bar and tried to take a modular approach, meaning, you know, once we meet our goal, we'll do this section of the orchestra. And then if we meet a higher goal, we'll do this section of the orchestra, and et cetera, et cetera. And I had listed choir as one of the last goals because in my mind, you know, the choir is kind of supportive. It's in the background of a lot of the tracks. It doesn't really take the center stage very often. I thought, you know, a live choir would make probably the least amount of difference compared to strings, brass, and woodwinds. And when we got in there and actually recorded a live choir, I was blown away. It made almost more difference than some of the other sections where I thought would be more important. It was really interesting.
Wow. Well, writing for chorus is a unique talent too, because you've got to give them space to breathe and get the phrasing right so it sounds really natural. And so, yeah, I can imagine hearing a live chorus versus the samples. It must have been amazing.
Oh, absolutely. And I've been really lucky with choirs. I've been singing in choirs all my life and did a lot of private study with Dr. Barlow Bradford up here at the University of Utah. And he is a fantastic choral arranger and composer. He's also a very accomplished conductor and holds some world championships with his university choirs. And he's really taught me quite a bit about orchestration and about choral writing. And he's also given me the opportunity to perform a lot of my own choral arrangements. So I actually took this album to him a couple weeks ago and sat down and listened to it with him when he had the score. And he was very impressed with the choral writing, which was a huge compliment to me, you know, having your mentor be proud of you, I guess.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's like, you know, the student has become the master, kind of. And so,
yeah. Of course. Back to different tracks.
Sure.
I did also want to mention track 13, The Orphan Dreamer, is both a favorite and a least favorite of mine, partially because I love the way that track is very, very sweeping. It's very cinematic. It kind of serves as a quasi love theme, even though there really isn't a love theme in the game. It's kind of my heroine track.
Thank you.
that track, I love the way it turned out, but at the same time, I hate the way it turns out because I feel it could have been so much more if I had had the chance with a larger orchestra. So it's kind of a what-if scenario with that track.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's a tough field because, you know, I've talked with a lot of composers who have to do their best work on a really, really tight deadline and or work within whatever the budget allows. And so, yeah, a lot of them, they'll go back and say, geez, you know, if I just had do-overs, if I had another 2 weeks.
In my case, it'd be another $50,000,
right.
But, you know. No, when I originally pitched the project, I really wanted to record Cross Symphonic with a 90-piece orchestra. That was always the goal, and that's kind of what I wrote for. And we ended up recording with about the equivalent of a 60-piece orchestra, which is still really sizable.
Yeah, that's about the size of a standard symphony orchestra. So.
Yeah, no, it is. You're absolutely right. It's just a hair shy of maybe like 20 players shy of a Mahler orchestra or something that Williams would use on a Star Wars film, which was kind of where I was going. But, you know, what we got was actually really fantastic and turned out almost better than my expectations in some ways. So I really don't have a lot to complain about.
Well, no. And sometimes when you do use a smaller orchestra, you can hear the individual players a little bit better and the texture mm-hmm. is a little more transparent. And
sure.
So I think that the balance between an epic scale and the sound that you got is really fantastic.
Oh, thank you.
So how did you pull the orchestra together? I mean, who did you go to get everybody together on the soundstage?
We ended up with a group called CMG Music Recording in Hollywood, and they were the product of some research, because I've done a few recording projects in the past, and we've used union orchestras in the past, and I haven't had fantastic experiences with the union. The contracts are always extremely limiting and somewhat disturbing when you really read the fine print and find out what you own and what you don't own and what rights you have and what you don't have. And so when we set out to do this, we decided really early on that we didn't want to use the union. So we really put a search out all around the country for different orchestras that worked on a buyout, which is you don't have to pay any union royalties after the fact. Once you record the music and pay the money, you own the music. And it really became it became pretty obvious pretty quickly that we were either going to record in Nashville or we were going to record in Los Angeles. Both had, you know, fairly reputable non-union orchestras. And we went to LA for logistical reasons. It was cheaper to get there. I had family there we could stay with. We were familiar with the area, the players, the facilities. And so it ended up being better for us budget-wise and just peace of mind.
Yeah, well, you were introduced to me through John Robert Matz, who's with the Game Brass, and you
right.
gave them a chance to shine on this album, too. And so how did you hook up with them?
That's a great question. First of all, John is a fantastic individual, and he went absolutely above and beyond the call of duty on this album. I really can't thank him enough. And John, if you happen to listen to this at some point, again, thank you so much for all of the hard work that you did. To answer the question, though, they actually came to me, which was interesting.
Yeah.
So during the Kickstarter, a company called Materia Collective had kind of tweeted this out and, you know, kind of given their fans a heads up that, hey, this was going on. And I'm not 100% positive that's how John heard of it, but I know that he has a history with them. And he ended up backing the Kickstarter to support us. And when the Kickstarter ended, we had only reached our funding goal for strings and woodwinds. So that was going to be the extent of the recording, and the brass and percussion and choir, etc., were all going to be synthesized virtual instruments. And so the Kickstarter ended. I kind of announced the plan, said, hey, you know, I'm going to start contracting the orchestra and things like this. And he sent me a message and said, it would really be a crime to use synthesized brass on this project. Everything else sounds so great. Would you be interested in letting my group, the Game Brass, record your brass parts? Here are some samples of our work. We can talk pricing later. So I listened to a few things and I was thoroughly impressed. And I wrote him back and said, hey, that would be great. What did you have in mind? And, you know, the rest is history. Yeah.
Wow. It really makes a huge, huge difference to have real brass versus samples. And yeah, I've talked with actually John and all of his cohorts with the Game Brass a couple times.
Yeah.
They are just a great bunch of guys. I mean, it's just...
Oh, fantastic group of people.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. So
really, it's really some world-class playing,
yeah,
for sure.
Absolutely. So what were the recording sessions like?
Stressful. Let me tell you. So this music is really, really hard. It is not easy music. And you know, anyone that plays in an orchestra can listen to that, and they already can identify where things are going to be extremely difficult just by listening. And we took this into the studio, and the orchestra really struggled the first day. We did this over 2 days, and it caught them all off guard. None of them were expecting this to be, you know, quite as difficult as it was. It to them, it just sounded like, oh, it's going to be one of those easy projects. We walk in, we record a few, you know, string pads, and we'll be done. And, you know, they walked in there and they got hit with this big symphonic project. It shocked them all. And I think a few of them probably went home and practiced for a few hours after the session, because they came back the next day and it was a brand new orchestra, and things just kind of flew from there. But during the recording session, we actually had some technical difficulties in the studio that gave the orchestra some time to practice in between while they were waiting for, you know, mics to be swapped out and things like that. And, you know, as I'm sitting there pulling my hair, watching the clock tick and the money go down the drain, suddenly things just clicked and we were able to just mow through the rest of the album before time ran out. And we ended up with a really great product.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we recorded the strings and the woodwinds together in the same studio at East West in LA. And then we did the choir in Salt Lake at a studio called LA East, which is owned by Warner Chapel. And that was just a huge blessing. I did not have the budget for the choir, but we had the brass, we had the strings, we had the woodwinds. And I said, you know, we've come this far. I can't in good conscience not go the extra mile on this. And so, you know, I've sung in choirs in Utah my entire life, both professional and with universities. And I put out a phone call and a call for help to every single person that I've ever sung with that I knew, that I trusted and respected. And almost all of them unanimously came back and said, yeah, sure, well, we'd love to come do this for you, you know, no cost. And so I had a volunteer choir really at a world-class caliber come in and record this in an evening with me. All I had to pay was the studio costs. And I mean, huge shout out to them. Again, they made a world of difference.
Wow. That's phenomenal. That's such a cool story. And I think it really illustrates again, you know, how tight the music community is. I mean, mm-hmm. You can pull these people together to help on a project that, you know, they might not even have known about, and yet
yeah.
Here they are sounding amazing and donating their talent. And
right. Well, and you know, it's a huge testament to just how wonderful these people are, because, you know, that a lot of them are familiar with my music. That a lot of us have met through singing in Dr. Barlow Bradford's choirs. And you know, a lot of us still sing together in some of his, he has a professional choir called the Utah Chamber Artists that I have been a part of for many years. I actually have not sung this season, though, now that I say that. no, I've sung with them for many years in Utah Chamber Artists. A lot of us sing together with the Utah Symphony. And so these are all professional singers. And to call them up and have them all be like, oh, yeah, sure, we'll come, you know, do a session with you for free, is just hugely humbling and just a testament to how wonderful these people are. I mean, it was a brutal recording session. We recorded, I think, for, oh, it was 5 or 6 hours starting at 8 o'clock at night after everyone had got off work. And most of them went home around 11 to midnight. And
wow.
To have them come in after a busy day at work and donate their time, you know, it's just incredible. I couldn't be more grateful to these people. Thank you.
It's such an incredible sound, the way you just pulled it all together. And then I imagine going through all of the recordings of the different takes and stuff, that must have been a huge, huge job. So who did you have helping you do the post-production and the mastering?
All right. Well, first of all, we had an engineer called, or his name is Les Brockman, and he is a guy that I've worked with in the past, a really great studio engineer. He really specializes in live orchestras and things like that. He actually does a lot with jazz too, which is interesting. But he recorded the orchestra at East West, and then he took all of that home and did post-production. And actually, I drove down to LA on two separate occasions to go through takes with him, where we just sat for a day and listened to things and chose what sounded good, what didn't, you know, addressed potential problems and all of that. And then he took those and mixed them, and we communicated remotely, approving and tweaking and things like that. And during all of that, he had his own assistants that worked on this as well. And I don't have their names in front of me, but they were also some really fantastic people that just knew Pro Tools, which is the program we used to cut this all up and record it and everything. And they knew that program backwards and forwards, and they just really pulled off some remarkable editing that helped with some less than stellar spots.
Well, what's really amazing is it doesn't sound like it was recorded in different sessions and in different locations, because the yeah. mastering and all of the sound of it, it just all comes together. I mean, if you didn't know, you'd swear everybody was in a concert hall all together. So they did
that is the magic of reverb. No, that was one of the things that took us quite a while to nail. And there were more times than one where Les would call me up and say, "Man, you're just you have ears of an eagle," or I don't remember exactly how he worded it, but he said, you hear things that no one else can hear. And I would reply, I said, "I know, but I've got to be happy with it too." And so we spent a little bit extra money and we worked on those little details, which I think make a world of difference, that in reality, he's probably right and no one would have noticed.
Yeah, well, but you have to be happy with it because, you know, your name's on it. So, yeah.
Exactly. Well, and then after he was done, we took it to the Bakery Mastering House in LA, and it was mastered by Jet Galindo, who does a lot with the video game cover community as well as other professional things. And she's fantastic. And she turned this stuff around, and I was a little picky on a few things, and she just nailed it. She took it like a champ. She was absolutely professional. Can't recommend them enough if you know anybody that's looking to master an album.
Wow. Well, one of the things I was just thinking about as you were talking about the recording session is, since this wasn't going to be the soundtrack for a game, it wasn't tied to having a specific tempo for, like, matching a character's mm-hmm. footfalls or the action right. in a cutscene. So did that give you a little bit more freedom with, like, tempos and freedom to have a little bit of rubato? Or did you still have to use a click track to make sure everybody stayed together?
Well, we still had to use a click track just because of the way we recorded it. I mean, because it was in sections and everyone was not recording at the same time, it was very important that timings lined up, especially with the way the music is written, you know, symphonically. It's not one section doesn't really stand out over another. They all interweave together and play off each other. So we did have to use a click track, but at the same time, you're absolutely right. I did have a lot more freedom when arranging this to kind of just set up the scenes exactly how I envisioned them in my head and to progress the story in a way that I felt was appropriate, rather than, you know, trying to meet a director's vision or someone else's vision or being locked to a picture, like you mentioned.
Yeah. So that must have made it, and on the one hand, it gave you a whole lot of freedom, but on the other hand, that can be a little bit scary because.
Oh, absolutely. No, you are not wrong. The one hand, the freedom was great. I love having freedom to do what I want, but at the same time, sometimes when you have too many options, it's really hard to narrow things down and kind of set a direction.
Yeah, I'll bet. And especially because you didn't really know for sure what kind of a size of ensemble you were going to end up with. And I know with a lot of the composers that I've talked with, they know what the budget is right off the bat, and they know how many musicians they can hire or if they're going to have to use samples. And so setting right. those limits right off the bat kind of frees them up then to just compose.
Well,
so.
And to take that a step further, I didn't even know how long this album was going to be. When I started it, I had not sat down and penned out a timeline or anything like that, or a track count or anything. I just said, I'm going to write until the story is done, and that'll be as few or as many tracks as it's going to be. And originally, just to take that a little bit further, I had never planned to do this with a live orchestra. It was always just going to be a bunch of MIDI mockups that I was just going to put out there and say, hey, I hope, the Chrono community enjoys this.
Wow. Well, clearly it expanded way, way, way beyond that. And, you'd mentioned your work in choruses and your studies. And how did you get the skills, the other skills, the orchestration skills? I mean, and what got you started studying music in the first place?
Well, that's a great question, and hopefully I can answer it coherently. starting at the end of the question, what got me into music in the first place? Again, it goes back to listening to those video game soundtracks while I would just play with Legos as a kid, or go out and do my own thing. The music in those games always really spoke to me on an emotional level. I was one of those kids that would pick up a stick and go outside and be a knight in shining armor and play for hours fighting dragons. And sometimes I would take that music with me and I would turn it on and I would be the character from that game, and I would play with my friends and we would live our own adventures. And then as that progressed, I was always involved in music growing up. My grandpa was a piano teacher. So of course my mom enrolled us in piano lessons with him, me and my siblings, the royal we, as it were. So she would enroll us in piano lessons. And I took that all the way up until my senior year of high school, where I had also picked up cello in ninth grade and singing in ninth grade. And so I was doing all three, and I took those all the way up until I graduated high school. And then at that point, I had kind of fallen in love with singing. Embarrassingly enough, I don't know why I'm ever admitting this, but I wanted to be the next Josh Groban. he was my idol at the time. And so I auditioned at several universities around the state with both cello and voice, and they offered me scholarships in both, and I ended up picking voice because it was a slightly better scholarship. And so I got my degree actually in vocal performance. I studied a lot of opera, sang a lot of opera and musical theater through college. Somewhere in there, I kind of fell in love with composing. I had always done a little bit, I took music theory in high school and we had done a little composing there and it was always fun. And then actually at a local church, they asked me if I would arrange some stuff for an album that they were doing, and they wanted, some basic orchestra stuff. And so I was a sophomore in college at that time, and I had just enrolled in Dr. Bradford's choir class. And this was his first year at the university, and he was doing some of his own arrangements for the choir, and we sang those. And I thought, I'm doing this church project. It would be really cool to get his opinion. He does a lot with orchestras and choirs. And so I took the music to him and showed it to him, and he says, well, this is very good for pop stuff. And I was feeling all proud of myself. I'm like, oh, yeah, sweet. I did something good. And then he looks at me and he goes, would you like me to help you make it good? And I kind of took that. I said, well, OK, sure. And he marked up my paper so until the point that there was more red on the paper than there were black notes. And I took that home and I reworked it in 2 days, and I took it back to him, and he was completely floored that I was able to turn it around that quickly. And it was, I had adopted everything that he had talked about. And from that point on, he kind of took me under his wing, and I worked on and off privately with him up until I graduated college. And I'll still take things to him for opinions now and then. But he really got me into orchestrating. I kind of took it as a challenge when he marked up my paper. And so I did that, and I recorded that church album, and then I did a few student films because I had a friend that knew I had the chops to do something with orchestra. And from there, it just kind of took on its own life. And by the time I graduated college, I loved composing way more than I loved singing. So I kind of gave up the singing thing and started focusing on composing.
Wow, that's so cool. And it's interesting that, you think your career is going to go one way, and then you discover that you love this other thing even more. And so that is really cool. So
yeah, well, the funny thing with that, too, is that you know, back in my Josh Groban dreams, I had always tried to write my own pop songs, and they were horrible. I can't stress enough. They were just bad. And I could never figure out why. And one day it kind of struck me. It's because all of my melodies are very instrumentalist in nature. They do not lend themselves well to a voice, but they do lend themselves well to instruments. And that was kind of another moment where I went, huh, you know, so let's try this with an orchestra. And I ended up arranging some of those for orchestra, you know, turning them more into soundtrack pieces. And they will never see the light of day, but they were much better in orchestra form than they were in vocal form.
Wow, that's just so cool. And so what were some of the earlier projects that you kind of cut your teeth on so that you'd be ready to do something like this?
So the first album I ever did was that church one that I talked about, and it was called Beginnings, and it was just four songs, and it was arranged just for voice and orchestra, very simply, kind of pop, new age, Christian stuff. Yes, and so I did that, and they paid to have it recorded, and I took a production seat on that with two other people, and it was really my first hand at producing something, and I look back at that now, I can't believe they trusted me to do that. I mean, I was 20 years old. And they cut me this huge check to hire an orchestra, and we went down to LA and we recorded. It was probably a 30 or 40 piece string group with, I think, one of each woodwind and a couple horn players.
Wow.
And that was my first experience. And of course, you know, before I went down there, I talked a lot with Dr. Bradford, and he had looked over my scores and given me pointers. And, you know, I've also played in orchestra my whole life, so I kind of understood how things worked. And but the nature of recording was different, and that was a learning experience, and we learned quite a bit on that project. And then about 2 or 3 years later, that same church came back and they said, hey, we want to expand upon this album. Do you want to be a part of that? And so I said, absolutely. And so I took that to the next level, and instead of doing solo voice, you know, pop orchestra, we expanded the orchestra to be double brass and one of each wind player. So it was about a 50 piece, but probably a 40 piece orchestra. And then I added choir. I replaced the solo voice with choir, and we recorded another four pieces and then remastered the original four and released it all as a set album called Walk Beside Me, which is still up on iTunes and all of that, and Spotify. You guys can check it out if anyone's interested.
Oh, that's so cool.
And then I did one more recording session after that for solo strings and piano for a Final Fantasy project that never did come to fruition. So that just sits somewhere in a folder.
Well, maybe someday.
Well, so we'll see. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, also, and Cross Symphonic, it's available through Bandcamp, and it's phenomenal. And I should know this, but I'm not sure. Do you have plans for a vinyl, or is it just?
Yes.
Cool.
No, there is a vinyl in the works. I was actually supposed to have test presses last week, but there was apparently an issue at the factory and they got delayed for a little bit. But those are still scheduled to be released in March, the very beginning of March. And I think we're still on track for that, as far as I know.
Wow, that's so exciting. I mean, I know that there's a lot of secrecy attached to games and soundtracks and stuff, but do you have any other projects coming up that you can talk about?
I have many plans, but beyond plans, I'm doing a couple of tracks right now for a group called Pixel Mixers. I have a Zelda track from Ocarina of Time, and I have a track from Final Fantasy VII coming out. Those do not feature live instruments, unfortunately. They're just MIDI tracks, but they will be out soon. I don't know when those albums are dropping.
Wow. Well, if someone has a project that they really could use an awesome soundtrack for, how can somebody get in touch with you?
Oh yes, please do. First of all. My email is the best way to get a hold of me, and it's just john@johnpaulhayward.com. And I usually check that every day. I respond as quickly as possible.
Wow. Well, that's awesome. It's been so much fun talking with you. And I love what you've done with the music from Cross.
Thank you so much.
It's just fantastic. And it's been so much fun talking with you. So thank you so much for your time, and good luck with your future projects.
Yeah. Thank you so much as well, Kate. It's been fun talking with you.